The following shiur is being recorded for TorahDownloads.com, a project of the Yehuda Mann Foundation, Le'ilui Nishmas Yehuda Aryeh ben Yoshua Yakir.
I'd like to start off just by referring to something I've seen about one of our previous things. It's a little bit out of order, but it just appeared these days. We had spoken about vestiges, about organs that are vestigial organs. We had recently, 3 or 4 weeks ago, read an article about the spleen, that it's not as vestigial as was thought to be. There's actually an article in, it's called Science Daily, but it's quoted from the Journal of Evolutionary Biology, which is a very respectable journal, and composed by Duke scientists. Let me just read the main points of it. The lowly appendix, long regarded as a useless evolutionary artifact, won newfound respect 2 years ago, when researchers at Duke University Medical Center proposed that it actually serves a critical function. The appendix, they said, is a safe haven where good bacteria could hang out until they were needed to repopulate the gut after a nasty case of diarrhea, for example. The Duke scientists and collaborators from the University of Arizona conclude that Charles Darwin was wrong. The appendix is a whole lot more than an evolutionary remnant. Not only does it appear in nature much more frequently than previously acknowledged, but has been around much longer than anyone suspected. Maybe it's time to correct the textbooks, says William Parker, PhD, Assistant Professor of Surgical Sciences at Duke. Many biology texts today still refer to the appendix as a vestigial organ. Then it goes on to it, basically it's found way too many animals, and to make sense as that it would be a vestige, and that led him to the point that he made. The reason actually why we get so many appendicitis, he said, Darwin simply did not have access to information we have, explains Parker. If Darwin had been aware of the species that have an appendix attached to a large cecum, and if he had known about the widespread nature of the appendix, he probably would not have thought of the appendix as a vestige of evolution. He was also not aware that appendicitis, or inflammation appendix, is not due to a faulty appendix, but rather due to cultural changes associated with industrialized society and improved sanitation, and so on. So at any rate, I just felt it important to note that the more we learn, the more we realize that the type of thinking that this has no use and therefore it's a mistake, a vestige, or whatever it is silly. To base something as if what we know is absolute is never a very, very good way of going about things. Okay, let's get back to the point that we're working on. In this part of the series, we were working on the goal, so to speak, of Torah and mitzvahs, so life in its biggest format. So the first week we had spoken about, quote-unquote, from God's perspective. In other words, the tachlis of creation, the endpoint that God had in mind. Last week, we spoke about the endpoint from our perspective, and we explained it's a series of endpoints. You start with what you get out of it, tainug, and then dveikus, and then till finally the responsibility for the world, etc. There's one more system for looking at the end goal of things, and this deals not with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's point of view, not with our point of view, but actually the Torah itself. And let's explain first by getting a by starting with a Gemara that is kind of misquoted a lot. There's a Gemara at the end of Makkos, and it says that there's Tayag Mitzvahs, and David came and it was Hemidon and Tesvav, and Micha was Hemidon al Shloisha, Bocha Vakuk Hemidon al Achas. So each Navi boiled down the Torah to less and less points. the wrong, simple understanding of that Chazal is that less and less is important. So Ki'ilu Tzadik Bevenos Yechia means all you need to do is to have faith, and that's enough. Everything else is just extra credit, which is kfir, and it's wrong. In a sense, it is the Christian view of things, but certainly not our view of things. So what is the point? So what does it mean, bo ve'hamidon al achas? What's that all about? There are a few other chazal, and we'll speak about them in a minute, that give such a type of approach, and we'll explain what that means. When a person is a scientist working on discovering laws of nature, etc., and he has many bits of information, he has a lot of bytes or bits of data, and they are spotting a graph all over, and you have all these dots. Connecting the dots in a way that a coherent picture emerges, and that all the dots become examples of a common of a overarching law, is the way in which we perceive the world. And it's correct. Somehow we have the inner sense that the truth is that bits and pieces are part of a larger picture. The mind has a very, very hard time dealing with bits and pieces. There's a Gemara that says, the Gemara in Taina says, if you saw a Talmud that is Miskasha b'Talmudo, it's because Mishnoso is not sturalo. It's not organized. It's not. It's a jumble of bits and pieces, and that's very hard. One of the oldest mnemonic tricks is they show you like an example of. They give you a long list of numbers. Try memorizing it. Most people have a hard time with more than 7 to 10 numbers, memorizing random numbers. So what you do is you make a story out of it. One person decided that for 7 days he's going to eat 8 latkes each day and give some of it to his 3 brothers. So 1, 7, 8, 3 become part of a story, and so on and so forth. And if the story is cute, if it's cohesive and it's cute, people remember it that way. So the same thing is true. People remember songs much better than they do prose. It's not easy to remember a long speech. Memorizing a long speech is difficult. But a long song goes reasonably well. A lot of the old epics were written in sort of ballad form, because it's easier to remember something that's part of a flowing tune rather than something that is bits and pieces. Words are bits and pieces, whereas a tune, it has sort of a unifying melody to it, the rhythm to it, and that helps you remember it. So a person's grasp of things is much enhanced when there is a seder to it. And more than that, since HaKadosh Baruch Hu is one, it is not appropriate that the final picture is that the oneness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu has 613 ritzonos. The most logically appropriate way of saying it is, the one God has one Ratzon that comes to us as 613 pieces that need to be put together. So that means it is most appropriate to find the theme, so to speak, of Torah, to find the klal of Torah that puts all the pieces together. That's the pshat in the Gemara, that bo v'hemidon Achas. It was a process of learning how to take the pieces of Torah, taking the individual fruits, and understanding the limbs they come from, the twigs they come from, the branches that they come from, the trunk that it comes from, and boiling it all down to some sort of common shoresh. That is the study of Hamidon Achas. And that's what the Gemara says, the Gemara calls it in a few places, looking for Klolei HaTorah. It says that Lamashal, there's a Sifri in Pashas Hazinu, which is coming up next week. Rabbi Yehuda Omer La'olam Havikoines Divrei Torah Klolim. He says Torah is Lamashal to rain. You should try to take the Torah and put it together as a klal, rather than know it as bits and pieces. You have Rabbi Kiva says Ze Klal Gadol BaTorah, or Idach Zul Gemar. Zekal Gadol Torah, again, doesn't mean to say this is important and others are not important. That's not the word klal means. Klal means it is an overarching picture that takes in many of the details. That's the word gadol. Zekal Gadol means it is a very encompassing rule which will take in many of the details of the Torah. Ad kedei kach, that even Ben Adam Lamakom is included in it, Rashi explains, and so on. There's the Klal Gadol means it is a good picture to bring everything in under that picture. Yes?
I guess maybe on a more practical level, is this more just trying to understand what Hashem's ultimate Ratzon is in the Torah and the mitzvot, as opposed to understanding what the mitzvot themselves are? Because how would Tzadik Ben Munaso Yichei bring any understanding to any of the mitzvahs?
Okay, so let's go with that. Now, so the first thing I think that we've posited and that we've put down is that there is a concept of klal, and it is an appropriate concept, and there's the klal gadol and smaller klalim and so on. L'may nafkamina, actually. Let's phrase Pinchas' question in terms of l'may nafkamina. How does this come into play? How is it significant? So the first thing is obviously significant. It always helps a person when we understand things properly. That's good. It also is very important when we need to sometimes evaluate what's more important. There are some halachic pieces and that about what's more important than what. But then many times, let's say a question, should I spend more time on davening or learning or chesed? A lot of those questions will depend on how do I see the klal. It's also important in terms of a person's focusing. In other words, what is he thinking when he's doing the mitzvah? The Mekubalim gave us a formula. L'shem yichud kutcha b'richu shchintei, and I'm doing this mitzvah, this mitzvah, this mitzvah, this mitzvah, and the other mitzvah. That's sort of the kavana and content of understanding what it is that I'm doing. What is this pa'ula doing? So the Mekubalim gave us a formula that all mitzvahs unite kutcha b'richu and shchintei. But it helps us when we're doing something, performing it, we should be able to have the sense of what it is in the process that we're doing. And we'll talk about Tariq Ben Nasi Yechid in a second. Now, the klal in these things is that the halacha are the dots on the graph. Halacha is determined very specifically. And they are really immutable. They're unchangeable. On the one hand, they're very easy to determine. A halacha is easier to determine than an agada process. They never get pushed out of the way. But they are a very low level of what it is that we have. It's drawing the big picture together that gives us the deeper understanding of what puts things together. And that's called agada. Halacha, which means to walk. Walk is a discrete activity. There's a step at a time. I can slice it into real pieces. Discrete in a sense, like quantums are discrete entities. They are clearly defined bits that add up to something. Agada comes from the word negido, which means to flow, and that is a continuous activity without having discrete sections. It's continuous, like a river that flows. So when a person is walking versus a river that's flowing, when a person is walking, there are defined steps, but each step is an entity to its own. It's only when you look at the whole picture of where the person was and where the person ended up, that we have a bigger picture, whereas a flow is continuous. And that's the difference in halacha and agada. Agada means to give us klolam in Torah, and halacha gives us pieces. It is important for us to understand it because we function much better when we know what we're doing. Sometimes we need to evaluate different things and to reach conclusions about what's more important, what's less important, when there's not a halachic clear definition of which of the two has to give way. Let's go into some of the, I guess, Gedolei Yisrael's approaches. And there is room for an endless amount of giving a klal to it, whether in a big way or just a nuance. The two pieces that are immutable are halacha is halacha. In other words, if your klal fits 99% of halacha and one of them it does not fit, for instance, if somebody says Shabbos is a day to be together with the family, but your poor Aunt Selma, who's such a sweet old lonely lady, and she lives 60 miles away and it's hard for her to walk the 60 miles on Shabbos, and she can't drive with the car, then it's shot it out. And being there with the family might be a prat of Shabbos, but it certainly can't be the klal, because way too many halachas eliminate that. So the halachic bits, just like a scientist, he can theorize anything as long as the data is correct. That's one caveat. If the data is not correct, he will either have to label it as an exception for a reason, or will just have to redo the theory. The second thing, and this is a harder one, is klal has to be within the realm of Torah true values. Lamash, let's give the same counterexample to this in the secular world. Statisticians sit all day long and study correlating events, and they will study what type of economy produced what type of president, what type of foreign policy situation produced what type of president, Democrat or Republican or whatever. They just keep going with this and so on and so forth. They also have a cutesy division that has, like, in years that the miniskirt was popular, a Democratic president got elected, a Republican president, the year that the wine crop was good in France, this type of president, that president. They will try hundreds of different things like that, and every so often they'll find one that pops in neatly after that point. Nobody in his right mind is going to say, this is a very, very good indicator of the president. Somewhere along the line, there's also a sense that it has to be a sensible solution. So, in Torah Lahatul, it has to be a Torah value. If some perverted person would come up with that all the mitzvahs in the Torah enhance the worship of the Baal, and he would quote-unquote prove it, we would say he's off his rocker, simply because we know that Avodah Zarah is not a Torah value, and it's just not going to work. So we can take many klolim and have it fit the Torah. We must make sure that it sticks to halacha, and we must make sure that the ruach hadvarim fits in with the ruach of what we would feel are Torah values. What we feel means, by learning enough Torah, one gets a sense the Torah positive values are chesed and emes and tov and HaKadosh Baruch Hu and so on, and the negative values are arayas and avodah zarah and ra and so on and so forth. In a general sense, we do have a sense of what could be values, what could not be. Let's take a look at the different approaches so we get a sense of this. There's one approach, and this is going to be reflected later when we speak about yeshivas and the learning, let me go with an earlier approach. The Rambam in Mor Nevuchim goes through all the mitzvahs to give taimim. When you go through them, you're struck by something. Every single mitzvah has only one reason. The reason it is to affirm the Achdus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to negate the Avodah Zarah. And some of the reasons seem to be, some of it seems to be extremely accurate, some of it seems to be plausible, and some of it seems to be way out. And the Rambam's insistent on it. It's kilu straight down the line. Almost every single mitzvah and avodah we think of has to do with Achdus versus Avodah Zarah. The Rambam was reflecting that Gemara of Bocha Vakayuna Achas. At the end of the day, the mitzvahs bring out the Achdus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world. In a sense, the Mekubalim in their language had the same thing. L'shem Yichud Kutcha B'richo Shchinte, in its own language and in its own concepts, means a very similar thing. The world looks to us Avodah Zaradik. It looks to us like bits and pieces. And by bringing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's all-encompassing self into the picture, I am bringing everything and affirming HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Achdus. The Kabbalim had their own Mahalachim on how to do it. The Rambam tried to be very, very straightforward and show you how all that various of whether it's shaving, being makif, is kind of drinking blood, etc., etc., all have Avodah Zaradik Ashrashim. I want to make a comment about this also. It's not, the Rambam is not as facile as it looks like, oh, the Avodah Zarah drank blood, so Torah says it. This is going back 3,000 years ago, so why is the Lassa? They shaved the head, so the Avodah Zarah could have beard, so why? And the Rambam, I think the way the Rambam understands it is, there are activities that by their very nature have an Avodah Zaradika bent to it. L'mashal, you have Avodos that are considered universal in the Yisrael Avodah Zarah. Shchita, Naktara, and so on. So these are things, blood is used in almost every type of Avodah Zarah. Blood is a very important element in it. Something with the head, wearing a headdress, shaving it, shaving it off, shaving it on, was very common to many Avodah Zarahs. In other words, the Torah picked averas that seem to be very universal in their appeal of Avodah Zarah, and mitzvahs that affirm HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Achdus. So the Rambam's Mahalach is, Emunah is the Klal Gadol of Torah. Every single mitzvah affirms it, and every single avera keeps you away from lack of emuna, and that's how the picture comes together. The Goyen's Cheder, for instance, and it's or the Goyen also, but I'm just picking it because that's the most familiar one, place the emphasis on Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah is Keneged Kulam. Talmud Torah encompasses the whole Torah. The halacha is, given your choice, you should learn rather than anything else. The overriding chiyuv is Torah, and everything it revolves around learning. The mitzvahs we have to do are minimums to keep our neshama in its right place so that the learning is meaningful. And if we were to do averus, we could learn, we'd be mustar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the klal gadol of kol HaTorah kula is the understanding of it. So the doing of the mitzvahs is a tanai. It's a little more than menas lasos, but it's not the... But the tachlis of doing is that so that we understand. The tachlis of doing is so that that which we learned is emes to us and not just idle, you know, intellectual gymnastics. But really, learning is the klal kuloi, and that's how the cheder of the grain was built and based and understood. So, if a Jew wasn't learning, what to ask? What is my tachlis b'riyah? To help the person who's learning, and that way I become part of his learning. Just like the my stomach, why does my stomach have a chelek in tchias ha-mesim? Why is my stomach, what its purpose is to provide the nutrition and bring it to the brain or the hands or the mitzvahs of the brain who's learning. The same thing, everything is built around Torah. Support for it, the centerpiece of Klal Yisrael was all the tribes around the Mishkan. The Mishkan had the Kodesh Kodashim at its center. The Kodesh Kodashim had the Aron. The Aron had the Luchos and the Torah in it. So everything was focused on Torah and Luchos. And the only activity that is spiritual, in a full sense, is learning. It's a non-physical activity, really. And we use our brains, but we learn with our minds. So this becomes the center and Klal Gadol Kol HaTorah Kulo. Chassidus came along, and Chassidus said, no, the klal of Kol HaTorah Kulo is a person's heart, meaning what Rachman al Libavay. The Mishkan was the center. The Mishkan was the center of Chayisol, but the Mishkan was all about Avodas Hashem, Karbanis. At the end of the day, a person can be intellectual, but it's all about himself. It's not about a Kadosh Baruch Hu. The only genuine avoda is when it comes from the heart, and therefore tefillah is the primary expression, the klal gadol of kol ha'torah kulos tefillah, because tefillah is a total negation of self in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Torah is very important. It's an important mitzvah, and there's a chiyuv to learn whenever you can. But given the choice between davening longer and learning less, it's clear. Davening is the important one. Learning is the less important one. Is it true that a person who's osing Torah all the time, like Avshim Yochai, is patron tefillah? Yes. Just like somebody who works in the Chavar Kadisha is patron from Krishma. But you're not going to say that the purpose of Klai is to be in Chavar Kadisha. The person in the Chavar Kadisha is patron because he's being osing b'mitzvah. The person who's like Avshim Yochai, he's being osing in Talmud Torah in a very special way, he becomes patron from tefillah. But that's not meant to be the picture of a Klai Yisrael. Shem Yochai is the exception. Just like the guy in the Chavar Kadisha is part of learning Krishna is the exception. It's not the klal of Kol HaTorah Kula that to become part of Chavar Kadisha is the goal of people in Klai Yisrael. So tefillah, so lev as opposed to rosh, tefillah as opposed to Torah, avodas Hashem as opposed to Hasgur Da'osi became the core of Hasidus. So interesting, we have two movements of Erlicha people, and both wholeheartedly wanting over Hashem, both keeping the same mitzvahs, with all the sniping at the Zman HaTfilah, is that, but at the end of the day, keeping the same Shulchan Aruch, learning the same Gemaras, and have two very different worldviews. It reflects itself on a practical level. In the Litvish world, the yeshiva was an entity that stood above anything else in the tzibur. A rav is nice, and a community is nice, and they're wonderful. A yeshiva stood in its own. It's like the difference between a major university and a high school. A high school belongs to the neighborhood. A major university is a force in its own. It's its own mitzvah. The yeshivas became kaisor. That is kaisor. Communities are where you take care of your mitzvah needs and your daily needs and for people that are not learning and so on. That was a view. By Chassidim, the marshal, it was the other way around. The Rebbe, who was a big tzaddik, was the focal point of Avodas Hashem, and Rosh Hashiva fulfilled an important function. He taught people, but he wasn't the dominant figure, and everything centered around the Rebbe, who was supposed to be the Avod Hashem and the Mespal. Musa came along, and Musa had a different approach, and Musa's approach was that a person's midas are really what it's all about. They referred back to the Rabbi Chaim Vital in Avodas HaKodesh, where he says that midas are so obvious they come before Torah. All of the mitzvahs are there to enhance a person's midas. So besides doing mitzvahs as we're supposed to do them, working on one's midos is probably the most important part of Avodas Hashem. It's the only thing that directly refines a person. A person can be learning, and a person can be davening and yelling away and full of kafanis, but he is blithely ignorant of his own metzias, and he's full of terrible midas. If a person is betzalim alakim, working on midas is supposed to be the thing that makes it betzalim alakim. So that was what Musa preached, and once again, the fight between Musa and the Musa itself came into the yeshiva world with not a few battles and with a lot of opposition. And the opposition was kind of a sense, when someone could come along and say, in the standard yeshiva model or the standard go'on model, this is the way we would tell somebody. You're learning great and you're big time tchachem. You have a flaw that you're a bal gaiva and you need to work on gaiva because it's an issa d'oraisa, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't like bal gaiva and so on. In the Musa model, we would tell somebody, what's your learning worth? You're learning for your own aggrandizement, for your own arrogance. You're not learning for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so your Talmud Torah is all going to feed your gaiva. And that is the opposite of Tzol Malkim. It's the opposite of what a person should be. And your learning is worthless. It's a very different, conceptually, we're talking about two different models. Here we're telling somebody you're great with a flaw. Here we're telling somebody you missed the main point. You have the, all the ancillary material, you just don't have the main point. You can look at, yes?
Are there any other legitimate tzivos?
Yeah, we will go through some of them. Rav Shamsa Fol Hirsch in his writings, and it's not clear, first of all, Rav Shamsa Fol Hirsch was very big into giving the sweeping picture of things. It was one of his great feats that he was able to do it. His Sefer Chora, which gives a sense of all the mitzvahs, he started by going through all the points of what the halachas are. He also had, I saw his grandson, who was a neighbor of mine, a friend of mine, I mean, great-great-grandson, he had all the Zohars on the Inyan. Even though he never quoted Zohars, in Germany, Kabbalah was not considered, you know, wasn't kind of part of the legitimate Mesorah, so to speak. I don't mean a prakrit, I just mean it wasn't part of what people spoke about, and he didn't feel right to be for Tzibur, but he had all the Zohar Kaddishes down and used all those pieces to build a worldview. He had all the data and then made a sweeping worldview. Rav Shamsa Fol Hirsch's view was that the world in its entirety, the halachas of the Torah are to bring the world to its shleimus. And it creates a society of people that are noble, elevated, great people, and a world that b'meila reflects that. That's the style of his writing. It was extremely appealing in Germany, where that's why people thought. I mean, if your attitude is, you know, I couldn't care less about anybody else, how am I being perfected, then Rav Shamsa Fol Hirsch doesn't really talk to you. But when you speak about sweeping grand vision of a world, of people, of humans, of societies, and so on, it was a very uplifting type of approach, and many people today feel comfortable, once again, when people, they have more of a universal sense of things, when people have an inclusive sense of things, it also speaks to them. Let's give one more model, and that is the model of the Mekubalim. The model of the Mekubalim, it was that the world became flawed terribly through Aveira, whether it's Adamarishan's Aveira, whether it's prior imperfections in the Bria, and everything we do is there to be metakin those flaws, and once we put it together, we will have the picture it's supposed to be. So the talk is about tikkunim, about bringing together pieces that have become separated. That's sort of l'shem yichud and so on. I'm oversimplifying a bit, but I just to give it a general sense of it. So that was a picture of something that was also a different approach. So here we have five different approaches, all valid and all work. Just to show how far this process goes, even Hasidus, for instance, was no means monolithic in its approach. It started out with a big dogish on Rachmana Libaboy and the need to keep talking about the heart and so on and so forth. People in the literature world criticized Hasidim because a lot of their vertlach seemed to be, in the world of pshat and certainly of digduk, it's kind of off, to put it mildly. But it's like somebody listening, somebody who has a tin ear, and he listens to poetry being read, and at the end of a beautiful poem he says, I disagree with that person. I was there in the forest. The brook that flows there is not clear. It does not tinkle. I would rather describe it as a more of a rushing sound, and et cetera, et cetera. And he criticized it for the geography and the topography of it. I mean, the person has missed the boat. A chassidish word is supposed to strike at the melodic part of a person's neshama. And for a person who feels that way, for the person with that type of neshama, that's a lot more emes. The neshama of the poem is a lot more emes than the details of it. And so Chassidus did that, but then came along the Baal HaTanya, for instance, and he said an emotional arousal that starts with singing and clapping and dancing is hype. It's not emes. It's got to start with deep philosophical slash Kabbalah slash introspection, and when a person thinks about that, it arouses his senses. He ran into a huge machlokas. Many of his friends left him at that stage, and they said, you're taking us back to the Litvaks. I mean, this is not what Baal Shem Tov had in mind. He did not have a mind deep contemplative study. He had a mind pure unadulterated emotion. And the Baal Tanya said, well, that is nonsense. Pure unadulterated emotion is hype. It doesn't last. It's insubstantial. And Kutz came along and actually sort of was a Musa type approach. Kutz said, it's all full of it. Hype and deep philosophical contemplations are anesthesia to keep a person away from being honest about himself. When you're in the eighth rakia with the Baal HaTanya, or you're in your eighth dance with the Polish, with the other Hasidim, you're not criticizing yourself and saying, you know what, down deep, what I feel like having now is Chanton Kegel. And unless a person focuses on himself and rips himself to pieces, there's no emes. So Kutz came and was miming everything on emes and said, nothing is worth anything unless it is so bluntly emes, there's no room to mistake the purity of it. So we have just an example of a lot of different approaches. All of them emes, as long as they stuck to halacha and to a value that's a Torah value.
Just curious about this, Rebbe. I mean, all of the movements Rebbe's talking about here, I mean, the Vilna Gaon lived in the 1700s, the Baal Shem Tov was at the same time, the Musar movement and Rav Shlomo Raphael Hirsch, they all came in the 1800s.
Yes.
So what about the 2,000 years before that?
Okay, it is hard for me to capture a flavor of earlier period. The Spanish period certainly had a flavor that's discernible. It just historically we're removed a bit. The Rambam certainly had an approach. The Ramban has a certain sense of it. It's just harder because we're removed from it historically, and we don't have so much of the flavor of what went on. These are movements that were still somewhere attached to it. They still exist. They still speak to us. So it was easier for me to sort of relate to it. I can't do that with the early ones, really. Okay. Yeah.